This is The Guardian.
I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. A political wedge is a tactic usually used to stir up controversy and debate with an opposing party. And as we've seen this week, they're often divisive and scorned by voters. So why have we seen so much of it lately? And what are the risks involved in playing this kind of cynical politics? Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Deputy News Editor Joe Tovey about the media's role in wedge politics. It's Friday, the 25th of February. Good morning, Lenore.
Good morning, Gabrielle.
And good morning, Joe. Welcome to your debut on the Newsroom Edition.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Lenore, we've seen the Coalition try to wedge Labor over the last few weeks. Can you walk us through what's been happening and what wedges we're talking about?
I think that one of the first ones was the religious discrimination legislation.
In this age of identity politics, where we hear much about how we are identified, still many people from various religious traditions are concerned about the lack of religious protection.
Scott Morrison couldn't unite his own party around the rights that might be taken away from LGBTQI community in the process of protecting religious freedoms. So then he kind of got too clever by half and tried to separate out the rights of gay students from the rights of trans students. But then his own party wouldn't buy that either. And so he had to retreat. So then he moved on to national security, which has really been the main place he's been trying to wedge Labor.
I believe not only is Anthony Albanese not the right leader for this country because I don't think he has the strength on national security that I've demonstrated.
But it was really in a very cartoonish, you know, reds under the beds kind of way.
But the other part that worries me about Anthony Albanese when it comes to national security is that he has always come from the socialist left of the Labor Party.
He actually used the word Manchurian candidate. Coalition governments have weaponised national security from, you know, forever. But this really went beyond anything I've seen in four decades watching politics.
This week the Prime Minister said, hold my beer. Hold my beer. What I'm going to do is trash our national interest. That is what he said.
And it backfired insofar as the head of ASIO and the former head of ASIO came out and said, actually, Scott Morrison, you're the one, well, not in so many words, but in effect, that he was endangering national security by using it in a divisive and partisan way.
See, if you're looking for a Manchurian candidate, he sits over there. Because he has served with the campaign that has happened.
So I guess that's the backstory, and we finished those last two sitting weeks with, you know, all the obvious commentary about Scott Morrison doing, you know, whatever it takes to paint a negative picture of Anthony Albanese. And big question, would it work? Well, one of the interesting things that happened this week was that a couple of polls came out which suggested that, so far at least, it isn't really working.
Joe, what are those polls saying?
Well, the polls suggest that, unlike the government, most Australians don't see the relationship with China as one defined by a threat. They see it in a far more kind of complicated, nuanced way. So it seems as if, I think it was about two-thirds of Australians saw that relationship as more complex than the government wanted to portray it, which does suggest that the general public is not as susceptible to this scare campaign as perhaps the government might be hoping.
There are national security risks, as you've just said, Lenore, to this kind of wedge politics. But Joe, are there also more personal risks, risks of harm to human lives in some of these tactics?
Yeah, so I think one of the potential human cost of the religious discrimination bill debate has been the impact on trans Australians who've seen themselves really drawn into the centre of a kind of culture war.
And even the debate about national security in China, does that potentially alienate Chinese Australians?
Yes. So look, as Lenore said, both the current and former spy chiefs of Australia have raised concerns about the impact on Australia's national interests and national security from some of this China rhetoric. But we also have to remember that this is a multicultural society, that where a lot of Asian Australians call Australia home, and the risk to social cohesion and of stirring up racism is really real in an environment where you have governments reaching for a kind of scare campaign about a particular country. We've seen this bleed into state politics as well, where this week the New South Wales opposition leader apologised for taking a Chinese-funded trip, which is fine and fair enough and not surprising. But we actually saw him also apologise on radio for suggesting that Mandarin should be taught in all Australian schools. Now, the idea that teaching Mandarin is somehow contrary to Australia's national interests really takes this debate up a notch, I think, and starts moving into the territory where the very act of sort of speaking a Chinese language or being Chinese might be seen as suspect. And I think that's really worrying territory for us to move into.
I do think it's interesting to sort of look carefully at what the polls are saying, though, because it really is quite instructive that I think our Guardian Essential polls put Labor 9 points ahead of the Coalition on the question of which party voters trust to manage the Australian-Chinese relationship. That's quite something. And as Jo said, voters understand that this is a bit more complex than Scott Morrison is suggesting. And as Jo says, there's a good section of voters who, you know, who are Chinese Australians. So for them, it is particularly complex. I think there was also the Resolve poll in the Sydney Morning Herald, which found that support for the Prime Minister actually fell over the weeks when he was elevating national security. So I think it's really important to think about, is national security going to play the way that the government and many commentators think it's going to play?
National security has traditionally been a strong point for coalition governments. Will the crisis in Ukraine help them? Will it change the way this is playing out?
Scare campaigns and national security campaigns usually work best when there's a pre-existing kernel of fear or something in the electorate that it's tapping into. So the Tampa scare campaign that John Howard ran so effectively, and a lot of people are sort of looking back to now and drawing comparisons, you know, whether we like it or not, there was a sort of undercurrent in the Australian psyche about people coming to Australia in an unregulated way. The scenes we're seeing from Ukraine are obviously horrifying. They're deeply affecting and unsettling. The Prime Minister is able to look statesmanlike as he quite rightly denounces the Russian invasion. That might be somewhat to his political advantage, but I still think it's harder to really weaponise something politically that isn't an immediate and direct threat to voters in Australia and that doesn't tap into a pre-existing fear that they have.
And Jo, some of the commentary has been suggesting that it could work because the electorate still doesn't know that much about Anthony Albanese. Is there anything that Labor can do to kind of fix this or resolve the problem?
Yeah, well, I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, I think those of us who work in the media and if you follow politics closely have known Anthony Albanese for decades. He's been a huge sort of player behind the scenes. He's a sort of factional heavyweight in the Federal Labor Party. But to the average Australian who lives outside of this area and who doesn't follow politics that closely, he's still a really unknown commodity. And that fact hasn't been helped by the fact that Labor has strategically been running a really small target campaign in the lead up to this election so far, so not sticking their head above the parapet on different issues. And that has left the field a little bit open, I think, for the Liberals to come in and try and define who Albanese is before Labor really gets a chance to do that themselves. And, you know, you've seen Morrison out this week calling Albanese the most left-wing Labor leader since Gough Whitlam. We've seen stories suggesting that he might be sort of a communist sympathiser, you know, links with union thugs, weak on China. All this kind of stuff, trying to sort of create an impression of Albanese before he gets a chance to do that himself. It doesn't mean that the Labor Party really has a task ahead of them of trying to, in the time between now and the election, set him apart. What does this man stand for? Who is he? I notice he's done quite a sort of fluffy profile with the Women's Weekly today, trying to sort of show the softer side of the man. But that's really the Labor Party's task between now and then, not just to sort of dodge these attacks, but to actually get out on the front foot and say if Albanese is not the kind of weak communist sympathising, you know, union guy that the Liberals are portraying him to be. Who is he? Yeah.
We know from what readers tell us that they kind of hate this cynical politics and the horse race. Will this wedge work or won't it? Lenore, as an editor, how do you weigh up that sentiment against we have a duty to report what the Prime Minister's doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the government is relying on the media to amplify its scare campaign and to run those stories. Now, some of them, you know, are well within the realms of legitimate inquiry. You know, what's Labor's record on defence spending? What's Anthony Albanese's history? Like, of course, we have to look at that. But some of them have been, these stories have really been, you know, quite outside the realm, at least in my opinion. They're like really risible. There was a story this week based on the fact that Anthony Albanese had done an interview with the Communist Party of Australia's official magazine in 1991, in which he talked about the challenges Labor would have were it to win power from then Premier Nick Greiner's Liberal state government in New South Wales. Shock, like seriously. Or there was an exclusive story about previously unreported remarks Albanese had made arguing for an inheritance tax when he was Assistant General Secretary of New South Wales Labor in the early 1990s. I mean, that was a scoop three decades in the waiting. I mean, seriously. So, I mean, putting that nonsense to one side, though, as you say, we do have to make judgments. I mean, yes, what the Prime Minister says and does is news, and we do have to report it. But it is our job to weigh up what we give attention to, what we contextualise, and sometimes, you know, a scare campaign or remarks that the Prime Minister makes are sufficiently consequential that we really need to put a lot of effort into that. And I think the national security remarks when Parliament was sitting really fell into that category. If, you know, if you've got the ASIO head coming out and saying this is a problem, you know, we really need to pay attention to that. Other potential wedges or scare campaigns, less so. There was a kind of a brief flurry this week when the Prime Minister enthusiastically supported a proposed private members bill by a Tasmanian senator, which was purporting to allow sporting groups to exclude transgender people from single-sex sports.
I think it's a terrific bill, and I've given her great encouragement. I mean, Claire is a champion for women's sport.
You know, if the Prime Minister was really upset about this, he'd have made it a government bill, not a private members bill. And also, there's no way this is going to get debated, certainly not this side of an election, probably ever. And also, there's no problem really that the supporting senator can nominate about that she's seeking to fix. She couldn't even nominate one sporting club in Tasmania that had come to her saying that this was a problem when asked on ABC radio. So this is really clearly, you know, a stunt dressed up as legislation in my view. So yes, we reported it, but we didn't spend a lot of time on it because that would be elevating it to a status that I don't think it deserves. But those kind of decisions, when politics is running this fast and loose, those kind of decisions come to me as editor all the time and to Joe as news editor. You know, we have to think about that every day. What do we spend time and effort analysing and discussing and contextualising, and what do we, you know, report but move on because we don't really think that anyone's particularly serious about prosecuting it?
This week, Anthony Albanese said in Parliament that Trumpian politics was creeping into Australia.
I've never been to a rally for Donald Trump. And what we're seeing here this week is the importation of Trumpian rhetoric where truth doesn't matter and facts don't matter.
Joe, you covered Trump. Was there anything you learnt from that experience that's helping guide some of your decisions at the moment?
Yeah, so I was a correspondent in America between 2015 and 18, so covered the rise and presidency of Trump, which was, I mean, as everybody knows, was kind of an exercise in sifting through a kind of fire hose of distraction, insult, bullshit, and very serious decisions that were being made every day. And the media, I think, never fully got its head around what is the best way to deal with that. I don't think anyone got that right because as editors, you know, as news editors, you're really torn between, you know, your responsibility to report on literally on what's going on. You can't ignore it. You can't sort of hide this stuff from the public, and it's out there on the internet anyway. But as Lenore said, you don't want to give undue prominence to events and comments and sort of thought bubbles from politicians that are clearly designed to distract from bigger problems. I don't think anyone came up with the magic kind of answer to this problem. I do think that finding a way to kind of report with skepticism, picking apart what are still the big issues that affect people's lives, which should generally drive journalism at all times, seeking facts, seeking to sort bullshit from the truth, that remains our task. And I think even as a lot of, I think, the reporting on Trump, there were a lot of missteps. There was a lot of kind of reporting of his flagrant lies and being distracted by ridiculous photo opportunities and insults that he would set up. There was still a lot of really effective reporting on the Trump years that I think contributed to exposés of his flaws in handling the pandemic. You know, our understanding of his taxes, all kinds of serious issues were actually ferreted out, I think did make a difference to how the public saw that presidency. But yeah, I think there are no easy answers when politicians can so easily, particularly with social media, manipulate the 24-hour news cycle and kind of use distraction, imagery and insult to try and throw the media off its task. And that is, you know, openly a strategy. Like we had Steve Bannon, Trump's former chief strategist, say that he saw the real opposition was not the Democrats, it was the media who needed, and the strategy for dealing with them was to flood the zone with shit.
Flood the zone.
Which is sort of the ultimate strategy, I think, for politics in this era. And it's our job as journalists to try to kind of wade through the shit.
Or clear the zone.
Or clear the zone, tidy up the zone, you know. But
I really liked in that context what a piece our foreign affairs reporter Daniel Hurst did this week, which was just a quiz about, you know, comments that had been made by various Australian politicians about China over the past few years, asking who said it, because it really neatly made the point that the relationship with China has waxed and waned, that politicians of all persuasions have, you know, sought to navigate the obvious economic ties and trying to sort of have a reasonable relationship with China, with China's increasingly aggressive stance. And it was, I thought it was a good way of cutting through the sort of silly reds under the beds rhetoric in a smart way and, you know, and an engaging way.
So they really have flooded the zone with national security issues the past 2 weeks. Lenore, what else have we been reporting that you think we should have been paying attention to while we've been a bit distracted?
Well, I mean, if you think about what was in the headlines before that, one of the big things was what was going on in aged care, the ongoing COVID mortality rates, and, you know, and how that was being managed, or most importantly, mismanaged by the federal government. I think we have a duty to go back to that. We have a duty to continue to report on what's happening in the welfare sector, what's happening in the NDIS. I mean, there's so many things going on in people's everyday lives that are probably a lot more important than a stunt or an outrageous headline.
It's surprising, I guess, in a way that what we aren't seeing so far is an election being fought on cost of living issues. And I suppose that's because it's something the government does not want to talk about. National security is easier ground for them when you have petrol prices close to or going towards $2 a litre, where we've had new data yesterday confirming what we know about wages not keeping up with the rate of inflation. House prices continue their sort of stratospheric climb. The pressure on working people in Australia is real, and the government prides itself on being strong economic managers, and generally coalition is seen to have an advantage over Labor when it comes to economic issues. But I think there's a lot that we're not talking about how much this stuff is impacting lower income Australians, and it's not surprising the government doesn't want to talk about that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, Jo. And also on the economic front, what they usually talk about is how coalition governments are ostensibly better at handling debt and deficit, but really in the current circumstance, I can't talk about that much either. So the economic argument is tougher for them to make as well. I think you're right.
Next, missing pigs and missing vibes. Now we come to what we can't get out of our head. Lenore, what was it for you this week?
Okay, I'm going lighthearted this week.
Yay.
There was a story from our New Zealand correspondent about a young bull that was swept into a surging river during flooding on the New Zealand's west coast and somehow survived being swept 80 kilometres downstream, which included going down the river, over a waterfall, through a different river, under a bridge, and then all the way winding down that river, and then avoiding being swept out to sea, and someone found the bull through the ear tag and called the farmer. But really, I'm mentioning this just as a sort of blatant pretext to segue to my favourite media stuff up of all time, which was a story in the Rockhampton Morning Bulletin, which said that 30,000 pigs had been swept down the Dawson River in a flood, when in fact it turned out the piggery owner had said that 30 sows and pigs had been swept away. I've been laughing about that one for 10 years.
Oh, my God, that is such a good story.
I mean, if you think about 30,000 pigs, it is a little bit implausible.
30,000 pigs in a river, I would not like to see that.
30,000 pigs, a lot of pigs.
Joe, what could you not get out of your head?
Okay, well, mine might be even sillier than Lenore's, but I've been a bit obsessed with this viral article about the impending vibe shift we're all about to experience, which is the topic of Saved for Later, The Guardian Australia's internet culture podcast this week. This was spurred by a New York Magazine article predicting that the world is on the verge of an impending vibe shift.
What's a vibe shift?
So the magazine sort of defined it as sort of cohesive sort of shifts in trends that define different decades. It was primarily concerned with kind of music and fashion. So the move from kind of what they described as the indie sleaze era of the early aughts into the normcore era of the early 2010s. None of this may make sense to other readers. I may as well be speaking in Russian right now, I realize, but this is kind of what the article was about. But it kind of got me thinking more broadly beyond that kind of very niche look at fashion and music and culture about the kind of broader shifts that happen from decade to decade after hugely defining events, say like the shift from World War I into the Roaring Twenties, or, you know, sexual liberation of the 60s, that kind of thing. And it does feel like after the pandemic, a period where we've all been kind of hibernating across the world for a few years, as we sort of emerge from that, what does culture look like? What does politics look like? Are we headed for a new era of kind of hedonism? I think that stuff's kind of really interesting to think about.
I've been thinking about that too, but wondering whether it could in fact go the other way. Like after World War II, we went into an era where people wanted to stay at home in the suburbs and have calm, quiet lives where they weren't, you know, in fear and where they just got on with living day to day. And I, you know, I've been wondering what the psychological shift will be after the pandemic, whether it is, as you say, towards hedonism and having a good time and getting out of your four walls, or whether the fear and the anxiety we've all experienced might lead also to a sort of another sort of 1950s type scenario.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it'll be different for different people as well. Kind of the return to nature. We've seen people migrating out of cities and into the regions, work cultures changing.
Yeah. And what you strive for, is it really so important to have all the things that you wanted to have, or is actually quality of life and, you know, time with family more important than that?
Exactly. What's the vibe, Lenore? That's what we're all asking.
Well, I don't know, but is that what vibe shift means? Because I understand that discussion. I don't understand what you were saying before.
Yeah, I think the magazine was a little bit more concerned of will we be wearing platform shoes or, you know, Tevers, but I was trying to take it to a more cerebral place.
Guarantee you, Joe, I will not be wearing platform shoes.
Well, I had to come into the office today for the first time in months, and let me tell you, I tried on four different things and I don't know what the vibe is my conclusion, but it's not what I used to wear to work before.
The thing is, I also think once you get to a certain age, you're kind of vibe proof and you just do what you want, which is one of the pleasures of growing older.
You're post-vibe. Yeah. I'm definitely post-vibe.
Thank you so much, Lenore and Joe.
Thanks, Gabs.
Thanks, Gabs.
thanks so much for listening, and thanks to Joe for filling in for Mike Tisher, who has taken advantage of the open borders to visit his family in the UK and Ireland. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Camilla Hannon. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me. If you liked it, don't forget to leave a rating or review and press subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday, and we'll see you then.